We are starting today by reviewing the last couple of paragraphs of the assigned reading from last week, and you all know that because I discussed it in the orientation. The reason I wanted to go back to that is because it's such a central point in most people's understanding. Let's see if I can make the picture a little nicer. Okay. Such a central point in most people's understanding of, you know, what they think of as the alternative to being stuck in our ordinary world. The idea is, well, let's get rid of concepts. Let's stop depending on the conceptual world, on labeling and all of that. And there's a lot in what we've discussed in the last few days which has that same flavor. I should say the last few weeks. It has that same flavor to it. It's you know, we label, we identify, we make rigid, we structure, we give definitions, and we live in that world that we've created, and we consider it to be reality, to be substantial reality. And that is a problem. So you'd say, okay, nope, we can deal with that. All we need to do is figure out a way to put an end to concepts. Not the easiest job in the world, but at least we say, well, we can see the goal. We can see where the path is going. And the couple of paragraphs that we're looking at here on page 55 are a discussion of that. But before I go into those, I actually just wanted to cite something. Now, I really could cite some things from the TSK book, which talk this way. But in TSK, that's a kind of transitional move. I'm going to cite something that I just happened to come across last week. I was going to quote it last week, but we didn't get there. Many of you may know the newspaper that's put out by Snow Lion Press, and they often have excerpts from books in it. And I was looking at it last week, and it had an excerpt from a book by a Tibetan Lama named Anam Tubten, and the book is called The Magic of Awareness. And so I just wanted to quote a couple of things from this excerpt. It says, when we go inside, and what he means is go inside our experience, basically, shockingly, we always discover the very thing that is preventing us from recognizing the most beautiful truth. I'm going to edit a little bit. There turns out to be a veil that is very thin and transient. The human mind has a very hard time. It has a desire to be rigid, contracted, and always lost in the vicious trap of analysis and ideas, with ambitious and arduous strategies and labor. This is mind's addiction. It is actually the prime reason for all our suffering. So it's this veil of concepts that is over and above direct experience. And I'll read you one more excerpt from this. When we turn our attention to what is holding us back, we find nothing except this really thin veil, just this thin veil. And if we look into that thin veil, we find out that the basis is actually this sense of I, or I am, he says. But if we look into that I, it is simply a thought. I is a thought that runs deep in our consciousness, but it is just a thought, a mistaken thought. It is a mistaken perception of who we are. That's pretty much it. Now, that's a nice quotation. It makes some really important points. I'll let it speak for itself, I suppose. The reason that I'm quoting it now is because that's not the approach that TSK is suggesting, or that this chapter that we're reading right now is suggesting. That is the approach of stripping away this veil, or tearing open this veil, and discovering the direct experience underneath. Now, maybe I'm being unfair to the book. I just read this little excerpt from it in Snow Lion newspaper, but certainly we all have seen things like that. And as I say, there are passages in TSK that sound very similar. But in these paragraphs, Rinpoche says the idea that we could cut through the veil and go directly to experience is problematic. And that's, you know, he lays it out pretty clearly. I don't really want to spend too much time on it, but I do think it's really important for the reasons I've just said. And of course, I'm very interested in what you might say about it. But what he says is first of all, the very idea of direct experience, well, I'm going to say some things about it. I'm not sure that I'm following exactly his discussion in these two paragraphs, but I am picking up on some other things that he says in different places. So the first thing is that direct experience, we talk about direct experience, but that very notion of direct experience is actually mediated by conceptual structures. And the main structure, of course, is the distinction or the division into subject and object. Right? So if I say, I see the tree, and that's a direct experience, I have no thoughts about the tree, I'm just totally absorbed in its beauty and its shape and its form, nonetheless, I'm presupposing a structure of me over here and the tree over there and the two poles of that experience. So we haven't really, in most cases, maybe there's some aesthetic experiences in which that division melts, but we haven't really, when we talk about direct experience, gotten away from a conceptual structure. So there's a second problem, and that is that when we have an experience and we say, you know, this is direct experience, we're looking back on the experience, right? We're saying, oh, I just had a direct experience like that. That's what, you know, and the problem there clearly is the same thing as the subject-object structure, but it's a past-present structure. You know, we're looking at something outside ourselves, at what just happened in this moment when I had a direct experience. So that's a problem. And then there's another problem, and that is, and this is the one that Rinpoche really focuses on, at least in this first paragraph, and that is that let's assume we could have direct experience. It's very difficult to understand how that experience could actually become available to us, because the whole point of non-conceptual experience is that we can't conceptualize it, right? And typically, at least, what that means is that it's habitual experience. You know, we know how we walk, that is to say, we know what it's like to walk down the street, but the moment we start to investigate what that walking down the street is like, then we've lost contact with the immediate experience. And yet, the question is, can we be aware of the immediacy of walking down the street? Now, maybe we can. You know, these are all just possible problems. But now let's assume maybe we can. Then the next problem is, if we're having that immediate experience in the moment, let's say the feeling of walking down the street, and then we, you know, we want to say, okay, so here's an example of direct experience. Again, and this is pretty similar to what I said before, the moment we say to ourselves, I'm having a direct experience, we're past that experience, right? It's already gone. So there are significant problems here. And you could add one more, and that is that the whole notion of a direct experience, you know, a direct experience is an experience that is not mediated by concepts. Well, that's a conceptual understanding. That's a definition. Is that a problem? It could well be. It could definitely be a problem. So those are all problems. I'm not saying that any one of them in itself means that we shouldn't aim for direct experience, or maybe all of them together. Maybe there is something, you know, maybe it is possible to have direct experience. But we ought to at least be aware of the fact that it's not so simple. You know, as Rinpoche says, we need to ask ourselves carefully, is this alternative really available, and not just assume that it is, and that that's the purpose, let's say, of meditation or some other kinds of experience, art, for instance, dance. So that's the issue in, that he's taking up in these two paragraphs. Now, I do want to make it clear that even if we assume that what we normally think of as direct experience is not direct in the way that we think it is. You know, it actually does involve concepts. It does involve a subject-object structure and looking backward at the past and the whole concept of what it is to have a direct experience. Even if we assume that it's not, a pure experience in the way that we like to think we might be able to gain access to, it still has value because it's a shift, because it's a very fundamental shift from the way we ordinarily experience. So if I sit down in a park and I find myself looking at a tree and I really get absorbed in the experience of the tree, or I should say the experience of looking at the tree, that in itself is a challenge to my ordinary way of thinking at things. Heidegger, when he talks about this, says, the Western philosopher, German philosopher, says, our ordinary way of looking at trees in our culture, in our economic society, is as possible lumber, as trees that we could cut down and turn into products. That's probably true for some people. But even if we're used to thinking of a tree as something that gives us shade or as something we kind of enjoy without ever really looking at it, the possibility of going into a more unmediated, more immediate kind of appreciation for the tree really does change things around for us, even if in the end it's not quite the perfect alternative that we tend to think. So, meditative experience, which does that sort of thing, it lets us abandon, give up on our usual stories. We find ourselves caring about the tree instead of caring about ourselves, and that's pretty valuable. So let's take a look. People have contributed a couple of comments here in the chat room while I was going on. So Michael says, substantial dimensionalized reality is like a pop-up version of an illustrated story. Everybody knows the kinds of books he's talking about, the children's books where you open them up and there's this three-dimensional paper structure that pops out of the story. Okay. Such as Wind in the Willows. Now he's going to talk about Wind in the Willows, which is a much beloved book, I think. There's Toad in his car, Rat in his rowboat, Mole lost in the woods. In other words, these are all the pop-up images that show up. But none of them are on a journey. Well, that's a good point. They are frozen in one version of time and space. But the flattened surface of a book leaves us free to weave and travel where we will. Perhaps direct experience is to knowingly become a character in our own stories. Well, that's making a jump, but it's an interesting jump. So the idea here is the image is frozen, but a novel, a narrative, a story like that is not frozen. It unfolds in time. And we can go along with that unfolding, that momentum. And that, I think it's a great point. It's like looking at the tree, there is a tendency at least to think of that as a static experience. But maybe one way to get more deeply into the experience, it's not the way that this chapter talks about, but it's fine. One way to get more deeply into this experience would be to connect to the flow of it. There's something I read years ago that is related to this that I like a lot. It was quoting a young boy. Maybe this isn't really true. Maybe it was made up, but it was quoting a young boy, and he said, I like radio a lot better than television. And so they asked him why. And he says, because radio has better pictures. And the point of that, of course, is that we bring to it our own creativity. You know, we're not just accepting something that's popped up and is frozen, as in the television show. Okay, Sudaba says, so I reckon, I like that, so I reckon that Rinpoche is suggesting that it's possible to see through these structures as they are present, but not so loud, and attend with awareness to multi-level happenings that are present instead of the monologue of the self's position. Is it possible to feel the multidimensionality of the unfolding of Leela? Okay, Sudaba's been reading ahead. Leela is a term that Rinpoche uses here and in other places. It's a Sanskrit word that means the play of life, the kind of creative aliveness of experience. And multidimensionality is a term that I talked about a little bit last in the orientation, because Hayward had brought it up as something that is, that, you know, he wanted to make sure, he wanted to get clear or make sure we were clear on what multidimensionality was. It will come up in the readings that we're going to go on and do now in the next couple of weeks, so we'll have a chance to look at it. But I think the main point that Sudhi is making is in the first part of the quote, we can see through these structures as they are present, but not so loud. And I like that way of describing it, not so loud, because, you know, on the one hand, they're seeing through, but the idea is that the structure, so let me back up. I think what Sudhi's referring to here is not the immediate experience. So she's saying, well, what's the alternative? And the alternative is, okay, here are the structures that thoughts present. Here are these concepts and this substantiality. But we can see through them. And then she switches images and says, it's like music that's playing, but it's not so loud that it drowns everything else out. It's just kind of a background music. So yes, I think those are good images for where Rinpoche wants to go. So let's look ahead to where Rinpoche wants to go. So this comes up in the start of the reading that was actually assigned for today. And so he, you know, in page 56, right underneath the heading, he says, well, we've got this problem. You know, we can try to bypass thought, and that's the alternative we've been talking about. Or we can try to, well, we can affirm what thoughts present. That's our ordinary default mode. We just think we live in this world that has been structured. So there's the ordinary structured world, or there's the attempt to bypass thoughts. And he's saying, okay, so there's a problem with that. And then he says, suppose instead, that, so this is where we're going, right? Here's where he's going to suggest the alternative. Suppose instead that we simply paused to notice thoughts as thoughts, the simple phenomenon of thinking. And he gives a nice example that I think helps clarify what he's saying. One moment we're watching a bird fly by, or enjoying a cup of tea, and the next there's a thought. And then he asks, well, how does that happen? He says there may be an explanation, but at another level it's just so. Thoughts simply pop up, sheer appearance, sourceless. So this is fundamental, and it's quite beautiful, it seems to me. So what he's saying is that the thinking process is on a parallel with the seeing process or the tasting process. And this is very much implicit in the Buddhist understanding of the senses. And Rinpoche certainly comes out of that background. So it's useful to see that it's a, it sounds like a kind of a small difference, but it turns out to be a big difference. So in Buddhism, instead of saying there are five senses, which of course is what we say in the West, Buddhism says there are six senses, and the sixth sense is not something, you know, mystical or magical. When we talk about a sixth sense, we're talking about intuition. No, Buddhism is just talking about the mind as a sixth sense, and it makes really good sense, excuse me for using that word, it makes good sense as soon as you stop to think about it, you know, when we open, if our eyes are closed and we open them, we see things in front of us. At other times, instead of seeing something in front of us, we remember something that happened yesterday. And it's kind of all the same thing, or it's all at the same level. It's like if you imagine that there's a screen, this is an image that people, modern Western philosophers, hate, but I'm going to use it for this purpose right now. If you imagine that the contents of our experience unfold on a screen in front of us, you say sometimes it's a bird flying by, sometimes it's the taste of a cup of tea, sometimes it's an image of the restaurant I went to last night, or a memory of a conversation or a plan. And those are all on the same level. So that's what it means to say that mind is a sense in the same way that hearing or seeing or tasting is a sense. So that's what he's saying. And he's saying, why couldn't we just accept thought or thinking as something else happening? Right? We notice thoughts as thoughts, as the simple phenomenon of thinking. So we're having a thought, and let's say it's a thought of the dinner I had last night. You might call that a memory. For our purposes, it doesn't matter. So it's a thought of the dinner that we had last night. And that thought is just like the taste. Let's make the example a little more complicated. Let's say I'm eating something right now, and as I taste the tea, let's use his example, as I taste the tea right now, I'm reminded of the dinner that I had last night. So what he's saying is, there's the taste right now, there's the dinner last night, and they're on the same level. The reason we don't think they're on the same level is because we focus on the content of the thought. When we notice ourselves thinking, we always go straight to what it is we're thinking about. And that's different from the other senses. So if I'm tasting tea, you could say my taste of the tea taste, is not about the tea. It's just the taste of the tea. There isn't anything that it's about. It's just the taste itself. But when I have a thought, there's the thinking of the thought, and then there's the content of what it is that I'm thinking about. So thought has this complicated two-part structure, the actual activity of thinking and the content of what it is that I'm thinking about. Alan asks, why do philosophers hate screen images so much? Well, without going into it too much, they say that the idea that you have a little man in your head, that's the way they always talk about it. There's a little man in the head, in your head, who's having experiences, you know, who's everything is flowing in. And they say, well, that's stupid. There isn't anything like that. There's no, you know, there's nothing in the brain. That's one reason people look at it. There's nothing in the brain that's like that. And a different kind of philosopher might say, it's not that we have the experience first, like the seeing the tree, and then somebody comes along to actually own the experience. No, the experience itself already has both dimensions. So from both those directions, the notion of what they call the Cartesian theater, people don't like it. But that's an aside, as you said. So we'll come back to this idea now. There's the thought and the thinking, or let's just call it the thinking. There's the thinking, and then there's the content of the thought, and they're different from each other. They're really completely different from each other. And so Rinpoche is suggesting here, well, what if we just focused on the thinking as thinking, the phenomenon of thinking? Right? He talks about that as the initial arising of the thought, and in that moment of thinking, it's dimensionless. Now, that's another way of saying it doesn't have a content. Maybe you have to say it does have a content, or in order to really get completed as a thought, it has to have a content. A thought is always about something, you know. You can say, if somebody asks you what you're doing, and you can say, I'm just thinking. So the verb can be intransitive. It doesn't have to have an object. But it always makes sense to have a follow-up question that says, oh, well, what are you thinking about? And there has to be an answer to that question. Maybe you say, I forgot. But in principle, there has to be an answer to the question. Thoughts are always about something. So for a thought to be complete, it has to have this content, this dimensionality, as he says here. But what Rinpoche says is, well, but isn't there a moment that you could, you know, couldn't you say that as the thought becomes a thought, as the thinking takes form, there isn't any content yet. There's this dimensionless moment, the initial moment, he says, when the thought is unestablished and the world is unestablished with it. And then he asks, could we stay with the freedom of this being unestablished, savoring its flavor? That's the direction he's headed in. We're not there yet. This is like an intermediate moment, it seems to me, in what he's saying. But it's good to be clear about this, you know, where he's taking us. So it's something like changing channels on a television set. If you think of the senses as being like the channels, you know, there's the seeing channel, the hearing channel, the thinking channel. And when you turn the channel, or you know, nobody turns channels anymore, that's very old-fashioned. So when you push the button on your remote to change the channel from 4 to 5, let's say, as soon as you get to 5, there's going to be some content there. But at the moment that you push the button, all you're doing is changing channels. And you could say that the mind works something like that, or you could imagine. I mean, I don't think this is necessarily a claim about the way it really is, but it's a possible way of understanding how the mind works. You're not saying yes, not saying no, just a possible way of understanding. You could say, when we switch over to seeing, there is, you know, you turn to that channel. And when we switch to thinking, you turn to that channel. And it goes back to this point that Rinpoche makes in the middle of page 56. He says, thoughts just pop up, right? So he asks the question, how does that happen? It's really very hard to say. You know, like I'm, you know, let's say you're listening to me talk, and in the middle of listening to me talk, you notice something in the room around you. You know? So why did you switch? Why did your attention shift? It's kind of a mystery. Maybe you could give explanations, but it just, that's the way the mind is working. Or in the middle of listening to me, you start thinking about what you're going to do after this phone call. You know? Same kind of thing. There's this shift, and we don't know what it is. So there's this moment in the thinking process which is not yet determined. It's indeterminate. And he asks the question, or he says, there's a kind of freedom in that. And he's asking, couldn't we stay in that freedom of being unestablished? Now, I said before that this is only a kind of partway step, a halfway step. It's free, he says, because in that moment the thought could take any form at all. We're kind of getting ready to think. It's like if you imagine a rocket that is taking off from the Earth, and in the first moment when it leaves the launching pad, I guess they call it, it's in the air. It's been freed from the gravity of the Earth, but it isn't yet going anywhere. You know, it's just free. And then in the next moment, its programming takes over, and it's going to go in a certain direction. It's going to head towards its target, the space station, let's say. So that's something like this example. But if that's all we did, let me back up, because I want to make sure that we're clear about this possibility. So I want to give a couple of examples that might help give you a sense of what we're talking about, this first free moment that isn't yet established, right? So an example that I like, that I take from my own experience, is when I was a child, I can remember the experience sometimes of waking up, and I knew that something was going to happen. You know, I knew that there was something planned for that day. Maybe it's Christmas morning, let's say, or maybe it's something less, you know, less dramatic. I used to, when I was a kid, I used to really like going to the downtown library, the city of San Francisco library. So if I knew that my mother was going to take me to the library that day, that would have been exciting. So I wake up, and there's a feeling of excitement. Right? And I don't know what it's about. I just feel excited. And then I remember, oh, it's because we're going to the library. Well, that's an example, you could say, of, you know, the thought is already there. That's what's making me excited. I have the sense of the thought. I know that it's headed somewhere, but I don't know what the content is. Right? So that's that kind of initial moment. It's not an example of complete freedom, as he says, because something has already been established. It's just that I don't know what it is yet. Another example like that, which philosophers like to use, and it's an interesting example, one that we've already always, one that we all know about, is what's called the feeling of knowing. You know, somebody asks you, you know, I don't know, what was the name of that person we met last night? And you know that you know, but you don't remember the answer. You don't, the content's not there, but the feeling of knowing is there. So there's another example. You know, you've switched over to the thought channel. The knowing that the thought is going to give you is already present, but you don't have the content. So those are some reasons for thinking that it kind of makes sense to talk this way. Having said that, that's not what Rinpoche is asking us to do. He's just showing us that structure, that possibility. David says the open anticipation, it sounds like the unnameable. Yes, kind of. As I said, it's not exactly complete freedom because, you know, you're headed in a certain direction. It's just that you don't know enough to get going yet. It's like the rocket, you could say, that has lifted up from the launch pad and it's free from gravity, but in the next moment, you know, it's going to start following its program and head off in a certain direction, you know. But yes, it's related. So what Rinpoche says is that freedom can remain available. And that's the reason that you know, it's so important to realize he's not just saying, oh, go to this blank place before you have a clue about what's going on, and that's important and valuable. No, in itself, that wouldn't be too important or valuable. It would just be a blank place. And if you wanted to live there, well, fine, but you know, your life would not have much meaning or value or variety. It wouldn't be very multidimensional. But what he's saying is different. He's saying, so let's look at this, the very bottom of page 56. Could we stay with the freedom of this being unestablished, savoring its flavor, so the flavor is there, without rejecting the content that appears through thought? Could we simply leave it as unestablished? And then he has this lovely line, could we unknow the knowing of the known to know anew? I like it just because of the sound of it. I just like the sound of it. But that's the point. The point here is the thought comes along and it has its content. It goes right into content. That's what usually happens with thought. But we don't understand that content to establish anything. We leave it unestablished. We stay with the freedom of that first hypothetical moment where the content is not what the thought is. It's like saying, well, maybe, you know, you could make it similar in a way to other sense experience. So let's say you pick up a cup of tea. Somebody's poured you a cup of tea. You pick it up and you drink it. And there's that immediate experience of the taste of the tea. And then maybe in the next moment, you know, the thinking process kicks in and you say, oh, that's some special kind of green tea. I think I had it before once. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. It just, you know, all these thoughts and things come along and we establish the experience. We name it, we identify it, we know what it is, and now, you know, we can throw it away, we can move on. But instead, you just stay with the taste of the tea. Well, in the same way, you stay with the thought as a thinking, even though at the same time it's playing itself out in terms of its content. So the whole time that, for instance, you're now saying, oh, I recognize that tea. It's a tea that I had before, and I think I remember. Yeah, I know where they must have bought it. All of that stuff's going on, and I just dismissed that before. I mean, I said, oh, that's just, you know, that's just making it fixed and frozen, giving it an identity, and it kind of takes us away from the immediacy of the tea. But that's a little bit like saying, oh, direct experience, that's what we're after. This is different. This is saying that all those thoughts that rise up are still free. They're still, it's a good way to say it, they're the activity of thinking. And the activity of thinking very naturally moves toward naming and labeling, but that's okay. It's still thinking. And it's still free. This is very much, and this is what Rinpoche goes into on page 57, and I think we don't need to, we're almost out of time, so we don't need to say too much about it, and can't say too much about it, but when you look at that discussion on page 57 in the light of what we've been talking about now, it's very much it's very similar to the whole discussion of space as zeroless, right? It's whatever space establishes, and we claim that space is zero, but in fact, in order to establish, it has to also be less than zero. It has to be zero less, and we talked about that last quarter. Well, in the same way, thought has to be less than its content. It has to be it has to be its own non-arising, which arises together with the content that it names. The content arises, but the thought does not. The thought stays zeroless. So I have to say that listening to myself as I've said this, I'm kind of convinced that I would be subject to the criticism that he points to in the third full paragraph on 57. He says, this way of talking is not a trick meant to establish a particular point or point of view. It sounds like a trick. It sounds like what I was just saying is a trick. But it's not. It really isn't. So go back and listen to it or read this, because it's clear enough in the reading. And see if you can get a sense of it, and then we'll talk in a moment about what to actually do with that. Let me just look at several people's comments. I think it's great that people are commenting. Lovely little chat window here. Sudaba says, is that move of staying with the freedom of the initial state of thought a sort of attitude, or is it a remembering that this is just insubstantial and I need to let it get too loud? I think maybe you mean I don't need to let it get too loud. I'm not sure. Well, you could think about it either way. It's a kind of, you could say it's an attitude, although attitude sounds like, you know, something that the self has. It's more fundamental than that. But it's a kind of an orientation or outlook, maybe you could say. Or you could say it's a remembering for that reason. And again, I mean, both those words, attitude and remembering, in their usual meaning, have to do with something the self does. This is talking about something more fundamental than the self, because the self, of course, is part of what doesn't get established. And yet a self, in order to operate as a self, has to be established. It doesn't work if it doesn't get established. So we are going to a level that's different from the level of the self. David says, freedom to not be carried away with content, even though being aware of content. Yeah, that's right. And Karin says, when I notice thoughts as thoughts, watch the thinking process, I get aware of the boundaries of my world, my knowing, and that there could be other possibilities, a sense of freedom. In the same moment, I know very directly that I am alive, that the next moment, this could be over. Life is so precious. Well, that's very nice. Thank you. I think you're pointing to the possibility of freedom. Rinpoche says, you know, can we stay with the freedom of being unestablished, savoring its flavor? And I think Karin's comment is about the flavor. And Brigitte says, this reminds me of the taste or feeling of the exercise abiding in thought. And thank you for saying that, because that's exactly where I want to go. If we had had time today and we got a little bit, I got a little bit hung up in the first part of what we were talking about, those paragraphs on page 55. So we didn't have time. If we had had time, we would have done an exercise, and it would have been abiding in thought. So I encourage you to, in light of this discussion, in light of these possibilities, try practicing abiding in thought. Let's see, what was I going to say about that? Just try practicing abiding in thought. Oh, I know what I was going to say. The reason that that's an interesting practice in this context, I mean, one reason, is what your thoughts depend, they only don't only depend on their momentum. They depend on, I got ahead of myself. They don't only depend on their content, they depend on their momentum. Thoughts have to keep going. A thought has to have its next thought, or the whole thing just breaks down. And abiding in thought is a way in which that content-driven thinking process breaks down, and it leads us back into, you could say, the freedom of thinking itself. So you could do the exercise with that in mind, and I will suggest, I'll say a little more about this in the orientation, another exercise that we could do, which is, let me get the name of it here, abiding in thought is exercise 5 in dynamics. There's another exercise 3 called playfulness of thoughts. And we'll take a look at that one also. Okay, well, I'm sorry to keep you a little late. Nice flavor, it seems to me, of a kind of energy that's related to the freedom that Rinpoche is talking about here. I think that manifested a little bit. Thanks, everyone, and we'll connect next week.